This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Now this evening's speaker, and I will be short, since I know you're here to hear E.J. Dionne Jr. and not me talk about him. This is the third time we've had him here to speak at the CAP Center, which tells you what we think of him. His new book is entitled Our Divided Political Hearts, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And that book is available for purchase and signing in the foyer at the end of the lecture. I encourage you to buy a copy and to read it. I assure you, you'll be better informed as an American citizen if you do so. E.J. Dionne Jr. is a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, university professor in the Foundations of Democracy and Culture at Georgetown University. He appears weekly on NPR and regularly on MSNBC and NBC's Meet the Press. His twice weekly op-ed column is now syndicated in 140 newspapers. He is the author, co-author, editor, or co-editor of numerous books. His book, Why Americans Hate Politics, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was nominated for a National Book Award. His lecture tonight, like the book, is entitled Our Divided Political Hearts. Please, a Santa Barbara welcome for E.J. Dionne Jr.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's really sweet of you. I thank you, Clark, first for that wonderful introduction. It is so much nicer than the one I received once that ended. And now, for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So bless you, Clark, for not doing that. Clark is a wonderful man, and I say that not only because he just told you all that you must buy my book, which I very, you know, Father's Day, you might have missed someone. It was just passed. So, but not just because of that, but he's an extraordinary man who's done extraordinary work in it for his whole life, but especially in building this amazing center. And Todd Capps, I understand, is with us tonight. And I was saying to him and some other folks earlier that the Capps family is very dear to me. I got to know Laura Capps when she was working for George Stephanopoulos in the Clinton White House. And I used to like to go see Stephanopoulos, especially because it gave me a chance to talk to Laura Capps. I got to know her around the time our first child, our son, was born. And she was talking at the time a lot about her dad, about what she thought of him, what he was like, his campaign for Congress. And it, just the love that she showed in those conversations was extraordinary. And here I was, a new dad, sort of hearing all of this. And so when her dad died, I called her and I said that she had given me what is truly the most important ambition in my life, which is I want my own kids to talk about me the way she talked about Walter Capps. And so I truly honor the Capps family. And I realized who you might have seen here. I saw all those great pictures. I'm sorry I am not Marian Anderson, Burl Ives, Robert Mitchum, Jimmy Stewart, Wayne Shorter, but I will do the best I can. The Cap Center is about ethics, which is, of course, why I'm here, because I come from Washington, and Washington is all about ethics. And I'm a journalist, and journalism is all about ethics. In fact, it's very sweet of you to come out to see a journalist at all. We're not a very popular group. It's why I regularly thank God for lawyers and investment bankers. They kind of keep us out of the cellar in those job ratings. You know, we journalists develop a reputation for arrogance. Indeed, many people say we work really hard at keeping that reputation up. But these days, you do have occasions to be humbled by your readers. You know, now you have all those comments underneath your column online, and your little email address is underneath the column, and you hear a lot from people. And somehow, they seem to write you, more people who disagree seem to write you most of the time than agree. It might be original sin or something like that. And there are many emails I receive which I could not recite in this distinguished setting. But there is one I have always loved. It began, "Dear Mr. Dion, are you as dumb in person?" And I like to bring that up because if you get absolutely nothing out of this talk, you'll at least be able to answer that question for yourself. And I also have to say I love politics. It's odd that somebody like me wrote a book called you know, Why Americans Hate Politics, my first book. It's sort of false advertising in certain ways. And I grew up in Massachusetts where, of course, you have to love politics as well as root for the Red Sox, Celtics, Patriots, and Bruins. And you know, Massachusetts, we're kind of special. Mary McGrory, the great liberal columnist, once said that every baby born in Massachusetts is born with a campaign manager's gene. And, you know, we have our own kind of elastic approach to ethics when it's necessary. There's a great, see, again, that ethics word, it's why I'm at the Cap Center. Oh, I do have to say it is. I'm really proud to be here for the third time, and I told Clark that I will soon be the bad penny professor at UC Santa Barbara because I keep turning up here. But the story is told of someone in Springfield, Massachusetts, a town about 70 miles from Boston, and he's preparing his will, and he. You know, the lawyer's looking at it, and everything makes sense except where he wants to be buried. He wants to be buried in a cemetery in Boston, 70 miles away from where he grew up and spent his whole life. And seems that this cemetery is in the district of a state senator known for producing a turnout of 120%, if that's what it took. And the lawyer asked him, why do you want to be buried in that place in Boston? And he replied, because I do not believe that my death should deprive me of my right to participate in the democratic process. But just two more. Coming from Massachusetts, I do. I love Louisiana. Anybody here from Louisiana originally? Oh, love that. You know, Louisiana politics can make politics in my home state look on the level, if you know what I mean. And there is one of my favorite characters in Louisiana politics is a gentleman named Edwin Edwards. He was the governor of the state. And, you know, he was not, in a conventional sense, he wasn't seen as an honest politician. Indeed, he knew, but he was very shrewd about the people of Louisiana. He knew that they knew exactly what he was about. And so there was a campaign in which he was running for trying to get back into the governorship against a Republican incumbent. And the unemployment rate in Louisiana had gone up to 11%. And so he went all over the state and he looked at the voters and he said, if you reelect my opponent, there'll be nothing left for me to steal. And he won. And he kept his promise. The state, the economy really did get better. And apparently, from what the juries decided, he did continue to steal. But the other line The other line I've always loved from him is when he said of that same opponent, you know, you're so dumb that it takes you 2 hours to watch 60 minutes. It's one of those lines you want to trot out at just the right moment someday. So I really wanted share that with you. I'm here mostly to talk about my book tonight, Our Divided Political Heart. I was moved to write this book because I love American history and the American story. And when you contemplate us, when we Americans contemplate ourselves, we're actually a confusing people, especially to ourselves. The self-portraits we create are often contradictory. The products of our culture, our movies, our books, our music, all seem to celebrate conflicting values. Is our country better personified by that lover of community, Jimmy Stewart, in It's a Wonderful Life, or by the rogue individualism of Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry, or for that matter, by the Clint Eastwood of the Chrysler ad that ran during the Super Bowl? Does Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land or Frank Sinatra's My Way speak more directly to and about the American character? Is the American experiment unique because it represents the importance of solidarity reflected in John Steinbeck's novels, or because it acknowledges the sanctity of independence celebrated by Jack Kerouac? As I say, Our Divided Political Heart grew out of my love for the American story and its tensions. There's perhaps a paradox in the book because its very first sentence refers to widespread worries about American decline. But the book is very distinctly an anti-declinist book, and I'll talk about that a little more later. It's a hopeful book about our future because it argues that what I see is the classic American balance between individualism and community and also between government and the market and the public and the private has helped us out of scrapes before and can do so again. I never tire of quoting Winston Churchill, who offered my very, very favorite take on us. Americans, he said, can always be counted on to do the right thing after first exhausting all of the other possibilities. It's actually something to be proud of. Some people never get to the right thing. It takes us time, but we get there. The fact that we talk so much about decline is actually a sign of what a high opinion we have of our country. We always seem to think we're in a place from which we can decline. Yes, this is the most upbeat view of declinism you will ever hear. And out of our fears of decline have come some extraordinary politicians and extraordinary political campaigns. Let's get the country moving again. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Feelings of decline usually start in specific crises in foreign policy or economics, or as was the case at the end of the Bush administration in 2008, both. But these concerns quickly morph into a sense that we're in the midst of a kind of spiritual crisis. We end up asking ourselves very basic questions. Who are we? We debate our history and history's lessons and usually disagree on what history says. Barack Obama's election, I think, was very much rooted in the sense that he was the right person to resolve this spiritual crisis. Think about his campaign. Remember those posters with his picture that carried only the single word hope? Or remember the change we can believe in slogan. I have always thought that that word believe was at least as important in that slogan as the word change, because Americans wanted to hope and believe again. And it is no wonder that the Obama campaign in that year so often felt like a religious crusade. So it's no accident that the Tea Party also responded to these fears of decline and a sense of spiritual crisis by reaching back to our founders and back to the Constitution. And my book is in some ways inspired by the Tea Party, even as it is very critical of the Tea Party's view of who we are as Americans and also of their take on the American story. The Tea Party was right to go back to the origins of our country and ask what it could teach teach us today. And I think those of us who are progressive need to have an argument with them. I think we progressives have been too willing to leave the argument about American history to our friends on the right. We have been too reluctant to embrace the American story as our own. I believe the American story is a progressive story. Should our conservative friends... Oh, go ahead. Should our conservative friends be the only people who carry around copies of the Constitution in their pockets? Why do we leave quoting the Federalists to conservatives? Why do we leave the Declaration to them? The most forward-looking politicians and the most powerful moral spokespeople in our history did not do that. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech drew its inspiration from the promises of American history, and in particular from the promises of the Declaration of Independence. Dr. King, for those of you who have listened to that speech over and over, as I have, there's this wonderful moment where he spoke of the promissory note that had been given to African Americans and had come back stamped unpaid, insufficient funds. It was the promissory note from the Declaration of Independence's promises, and it was a very powerful way for him to make his case. Abraham Lincoln's most important political speech before he was president was given at Cooper Union in New York City, where he insisted that the founders of our nation shared his view that slavery in the United States should ultimately be abolished. Lincoln did months of historical research to give a speech that the historian Harold Holzer believes made him president. Now, what do I mean by our divided political heart? The core argument of my book is that from the very beginning, we Americans have been torn by a deep, but I believe healthy, tension between our love of individualism and our affection for community. Too often, and especially in recent years, we have told our story almost entirely on the individualistic side. We have emphasized individual liberty to the exclusion of our dedication to community and also equality. We have not focused enough on how the liberty we do prize and should prize depends upon our willingness to come to the defense of each other's liberty, how liberty depends upon strong communities, upon energetic government, and upon a concern for the common good. Consider the very first word of the Constitution of the United States. The first word of the Constitution is not I, it's not liberty, it's the word we. The preamble of the Constitution of the United States goes as follows. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Yes, welfare is right there in the first paragraph of the Constitution of the United States. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. This is a we establishing shared goals. The Declaration of Independence is a perfect reflection of the balance between individualism and community. It begins by describing the unalienable rights that come from our Creator to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the very last paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, where the founders pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, they underscore that we cannot protect individual liberty unless we act together. They knew that the great thing they wanted to do could not be done unless they acted with each other. I also like to point people to that wonderful long list of abuses and usurpations in the Declaration, that all those things that we were, all those terrible things that the king or the British were doing to us to justify our decision to leave Britain and go off on our own. It's worth pointing out that taxes didn't come up until item number 17 on that list. And item 17 did not object to taxation itself. It didn't call for a supply-side approach or any other kind of approach. It simply remonstrated against the British crown for imposing taxes on us without our consent. The founders were concerned about consent, popular rule, not the idea of taxation. The very first item on their list condemned the king because, and I quote the Declaration, he refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Now, note that the signers wanted to pass laws, not repeal them. And they began by speaking of the public good, not some individual desire. They knew it took public action to secure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The second grievance was very much like the first. It accused the king of having forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. Again, our forebears wanted to enact laws. They weren't anti-government zealots. You have to go all the way down to item number 10 to get anything like a big government attack on big government. And I do want to commend my friends who do like attacks on big government. You really ought to do it as well as the Declaration did. Here's what it said about the king. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Now, that's a whole lot better than you're going to get in those 30-second ads sponsored by the Koch brothers. We've had a parallel argument related to the role of government in our history. I had a lot of fun in this book going back through the legacies of Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay and Abraham Lincoln, and also through the legacies of American populism and progressivism. As some of you know, I argue about politics pretty much every Friday with my friend David Brooks, and I walked into NPR one day, and I said, David, this whole book was worth writing because I finally figured out why you are crosswise with current American politics. David is the last surviving American Whig. His politics really do, and actually David didn't dislike that at all. In fact, he loves Henry Clay, Alexander Hamilton, and Abraham Lincoln. And I told some folks tonight that somebody actually told me when they learned of our interest in the Whigs that David and I could set up the world's most, America's most boring event in its history and call it Whig Stock. So anybody thinks that's a good idea, tell me afterward. But for the moment, I think we should let that one go. But if you believe that the federal government played a little role in the development of our country, you have to write people like Clay, Hamilton, and Lincoln, and a lot of other people, out of our story entirely. I ask you to ask yourself the question, when was the first federal health care program passed? And the answer is it was passed in 1798. The Congress established the Federal Marine Hospital System, and the bill was signed into law by President John Adams. We created socialized medicine for seamen in the United States. I have no idea what the power of their lobby was to get this kind of coverage, but looking back, I do not find any evidence of mass demonstrations against Adams care. And if you believe that the Constitution is absolutely clear and can be read only one way, then you have to deal with the fact that within 3 years of the enactment of the federal Constitution, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, two of its leading authors and interpreters, were at each other's throats over whether establishing a Bank of the United States was constitutional or not. Hamilton said yes, Madison said no, and out of that disagreement over what the Constitution said, came our first party system. I think it's hard to be an originalist when the original guys had a disagreement over what the original document actually said. My chapter on the Constitution is called One Nation Conceived in Argument. And I couldn't resist quoting my friend, the legal scholar Garrett Epps, who said that Justice Scalia and other originalists root their jurisprudence in the following idea, and I quote, "I knew the founders. The founders were friends of mine. I know how they think." Actually, the Constitution was created out of a series of compromises, some of which we look back on as not so good, like the one over slavery. It defends competing values, usually competing goods. And as former Justice David Souter said, deciding between competing goods is very difficult for a judge or for any of us. And I think we do ourselves a grave disservice to think that the founders were unique or sainted and received the Constitution as if like tablets from the heavens. I think we disempower ourselves because we say there was once a group of Americans who were so much better than we are that we have to do everything exactly the way they said in 1787. They were gifted men, and we have great reason to be grateful to them. But they were also adventurous men, and they were all men there. I apologize for that. That is gender specific because so was the Constitutional Convention. But they were also adventurous. They were embarking on a radical experiment for their time. A lot of the world did not believe that a people could govern themselves as a republic, especially in the large area of the United States. I think it does a disservice to them to think of the Constitution as a set of shackles designed to keep our country in exactly the same condition it was in 1787 and to prevent us from addressing new problems in new ways. And that, too, does a disservice to the bold and adventurous nature of our founders. Hamilton and Clay, for their part, were visionaries. They advocated what might be seen as national planning. Henry Clay, for example, called his program the American System. And what's interesting about this is he called it the American system to distinguish it from the British system, which he said was rooted in laissez-faire economics. The American system, as conceived by Clay, was an alternative to pure laissez-faire because he believed that government had a major role to play in building our country. The Club for Growth would not be pleased with Clay. Clay favored a strong federal role in launching internal improvements, those canals and bridges and roads that fostered commerce and bound the nation together. If I do nothing else with this book, I'd love to have the word infrastructure replaced in our popular conversation with the phrase internal improvements. Wouldn't you rather have an internal improvement than an infrastructure? Clay foresaw, as Hamilton did, an important role for the federal government in building us into a manufacturing nation. He was more than a century ahead of Richard Nixon in proposing what we came to call federal revenue sharing for the states. And while we shouldn't dragoon history too much into today's political arguments, I suspect that Clay would have understood the stimulus proposals at the beginning of the Obama administration, particularly aid to states and investment in those internal improvements and new technologies and spending for education, because Clay was an advocate of all these things in his time. Now, in frustration, once when his opponents were saying his program was unconstitutional, and in particular his effort to help American manufacturing, he said, "Do we live in the only country in the world with a constitution that is written for other countries but not for ourselves?" And so, like many progressives afterward, including FDR, Clay expressed frustration with those who did not see the Constitution as a liberating document to encourage self-government, but as a series of change. Now, I argue in the book that our friends in the Tea Party are looking back to an exceptional period in our history and turning it into what was typical. It was the one period in our history when a kind of radical individualism, as against the traditional balanced and tempered American individualism, was really dominant. I am referring to the Gilded Age, the 35 years from the end of the Civil War to the ascension of Theodore Roosevelt to the White House. The radical individualism of that period had enormous effect. It had a big effect on the Supreme Court and its decisions. It's in this period that the Supreme Court declared corporations people, a ruling that has come back to haunt us in Citizens United. And incidentally, I do think that the scholar who had the best response to this idea that corporations are people is Professor Stephen Colbert. Colbert, presented with this idea, said, yes, I want my daughter to grow up and marry a nice corporation. It's also in that period, in the aftermath of the Gilded Age, just as Teddy Roosevelt was coming into office, that the famous or infamous Lochner decision was made, which really denied the government any power at all to regulate the hours of workers or to provide protection for labor. And this made Teddy Roosevelt a great enemy of the courts and led him actually to propose that the people have the right to overrule court decisions. The populists and progressives came along to overthrow the Gilded Age. They came along to restore the balance that Clay and Hamilton and Lincoln had believed in. A lot of people look at the progressives as people who suddenly inaugurated an era of big government, whereas I see the progressives and populists as restorationists, bringing back what we had always been. Herbert Croly, the great progressive thinker who influenced Teddy Roosevelt, argued that progressives sought to use Hamiltonian means to serve Jeffersonian ends. They wanted to use an active federal government to ensure greater equality of opportunity and an economy that would not be dominated by the trusts or by a very small number of people. Those who are looking for encouragement in our current debates can go back to some of the things that both Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson said, particularly in that extraordinary 1912 election that I covered as a young reporter. Here's what Woodrow Wilson said. He said, the country was nearing a time, quotes, when the power of high finance would be greater than the power of government. Really, at times, Roosevelt and Wilson sounded like they had been hanging around at Occupy Wall Street encampments. The rhetoric was quite astonishingly strong about the dangers of concentrated economic power. And if we sought a balance between individualism and community in this period, or this new American balance, we also sought a balance between the state and the market. Americans have always been market-oriented. We always believed in individual initiative and enterprise and in achievement. But we also thought government was needed to check concentrated economic power, and even as we've used constitutional means to check the power of government. We have always believed that capitalism did not get everything right and needed some correction. And Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and their flag was picked up after the conservative interlude of the 1920s by Franklin Roosevelt, inaugurated what I call the long consensus. It was that long consensus under which we were governed for over a century that created the what we call the American century. It fostered a period of extraordinary economic growth, of great gains in social justice, of great gains in innovation as well. It was a period, in large part, of shared economic growth. In the 100 years after Teddy Roosevelt assumed the presidency in 1901, government did grow, but so did individual liberty. The state assumed new roles, but individual opportunities expanded. New regulations protected the air and the water and the integrity of food and drugs, the safety of workplaces and consumer products, and American capitalism flourished. Workers organized into unions that advanced the interests of those who depended on their labor, not capital, for their livelihoods. In doing so, labor organizations strengthened a more social form of capitalism based on widespread property ownership and upward mobility. We pursued the idea that wealth carries a social mortgage, that wealth creates opportunity, responsibilities as well as opportunities for those who hold it. Previously excluded groups were steadily brought into the larger American community to share in the economy's bounty and the responsibilities of self-government. We continued to welcome newcomers and created the most diverse democracy in the world. G.K. Chesterton said, Americans take in any old people who come along, and we made it work. The long consensus is now under attack, as it has never been before. I think what needs to be recognized is how far republicanism and conservatism have strayed from their own history and their own past commitments. They have chosen, on principle, it should be said, to make middle ground a politics impossible. They have done so by jettisoning their communitarian commitments, by adopting a highly restricted view of the federal government's role, and by advancing in the Supreme Court, no less than on the campaign trail, a view of the Constitution that would prohibit or restrict activities that the federal government has undertaken for a century or more. I actually have a lot of respect for conservatism and think we need a responsible conservatism in the United States. I have always admired William F. Buckley, Jr., for example. I always say I hope I can be about as tenth as effective for my ideas as he was for his. And it's very striking that one of the last books William F. Buckley, Jr. wrote was a book called Gratitude. And it was a book in which he said that those of us who had the blessing of living in this great country, its protections and its opportunities, had an obligation to give something back in gratitude. I worry very much that those ideas right now might lose even William F. Buckley, Jr., a Republican primary. What we have now is the death, the challenge to this long consensus. And when two sides do not operate within the same framework, identify the same problems, or even share a common understanding of our history, the difficulty of finding accord can't just be ascribed to pettiness or selfishness or partisanship or a lack of imagination. We really are at a time, we have reached a point that Ronald Reagan described in his memorable 1964 speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater. We are at a time of choosing. And I think the debates we're going to see over the next several months and possibly over the next several years are whether we want to continue and refresh refresh our long consensus or whether we want to throw it overboard. Paradoxically, by building on a sense of social and economic security, the long consensus encouraged risk-taking and innovation by making risks less frightening. Government underwrote the infrastructure, okay, I'll go back to that term, social as well as physical, within which innovation could occur. By promoting mass education, research, and scientific breakthroughs, government increased the capacity of our citizenry. Although I am unapologetically critical of conservatism in its current form, I would like to see a time when progressives and conservatives can reason together again. And I hope in this book, by pointing to both sides of our political heart, because we all honor liberty and community, that I might encourage progressives and conservatives to recognize a bit of ourselves in the other person. Conservatives do care about community despite their current political preoccupations. They coach sports teams. They are active in PTAs and Rotary clubs and churches and a slew of other organizations devoted to others. Liberals have always cared vitally about liberty. Where, after all, does the term civil libertarian come from? Most of them are liberals. And perhaps after this election, we can try to sit down and talk again. In the meantime, my hope rests in very significant part with young Americans. I am very struck by the commitments and the values of those in the millennial generation, the people who are under 35. I believe the new generation that is rising up is unusually well-suited to keep our national promise. In some ways, they are both the most individualistic and the most communitarian generation in our history. They are more comfortable with the new technologies than those of us, say, who came to Twitter at age 60. Yet even though they love the liberating power of these technologies, they use them to form social networks rather quickly. They are accustomed to the entrepreneurial society in which we now live and know that they are highly unlikely to work for the same company or at the same jobs for the whole of their lives. And yet they are also the generation that is given more time to service than any other generation that has come along for a long time, and that includes the 2 million men and women who have served our country in uniform in our two wars over the last decade. Their devotion to service is not, as cynics might say, something they do just because they had to because of a high school requirement, or something they do just because they want to get into college. And even if some of them did some of the service for that reason, the fact is that service transforms people, and it has transformed this generation, and that is why I believe that they are destined to be a transformative generation, very much like the greatest generation that went through the Depression and World War II. Now, I want to close by bringing together a kind of odd couple for you. I want to bring together the great Puritan John Winthrop and Bruce Springsteen. Now, you might have the suspicion that a humble author like me is tying himself to Springsteen in the hopes of gaining even just a modest share of his vast fan base. And if you suspect that of me, you are probably right. Nonetheless, I have been struck by the similarities of Winthrop and Springsteen, and I think they both have something to teach us. Indeed, they both have the same thing to teach us. Many of you will remember that Ronald Reagan loved to use the phrase, a shining city on a hill. And I liked it when Reagan used that phrase. It comes from John Winthrop's 1630 sermon, a model of Christian charity, in which he said that settlers in the New World would create a city set upon a hill. And here is one passage that I particularly like. Winthrop said, and I quote, "We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body." Now, does anyone doubt that Rush Limbaugh would call this great Puritan a socialist? Now, I don't know how many of you have heard the new Bruce Springsteen album, but there is a wonderful song on it, the first song on the album. And the refrain of that song is, "Wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own." Now, it's a real blessing that I didn't try to sing it to you. But wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own. Very concisely, actually more concisely than John Winthrop, he is expressing exactly the same thought. Both Winthrop and Springsteen speak to some of the very best aspects of our character as Americans. I think we will honor our past and build a more secure and just future by remembering, as they do, that building a nation where liberty triumphs requires us to stand with each other, to take care of our own, and to make others' conditions our own. I thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now you've guaranteed I want to come back here a fourth time. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. There are two mics in the front of the room, and I would welcome questions, including dissents. I want to tell a story about my love of dissent and how I kind of ended up doing what I do for a living, I think. I had a very, very dear uncle whom I spent 35 years arguing politics with. You could tell how divided the country was by how mad we got at each other at any given moment. But I loved him very much, and I've always been grateful that his kids asked me to give the eulogy at his funeral. And in the middle of the eulogy, I made a point of quoting Richard Nixon. And I did it for two reasons. One, I actually liked the Nixon quote. It was when he played off Teddy Roosevelt's talk about the man in the arena whose face gets grimy and is willing to do the fight. But as I told the folks in the church that day, I also quoted Richard Nixon because I was hoping that my Uncle Ray would hear it and come back to life and rise up out of the casket just to tell me, "I knew you'd be quoting Nixon someday." And I say that to honor my Uncle Ray, but also to tell you that I do not object at all to people who disagree with me. So I want to welcome not only those who agree with me, although it would be very nice to have some of those, but also those who might disagree. Ma'am, to the left here, if you could talk into the mic so everybody could hear you.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Dionne. Many people don't know or don't realize that communitarians tend to be fiscal liberals or progressives, as you have talked about today, sharing the resources. And on the other hand, they tend to be, many of them tend to be social conservatives because social conservatism has to do with lifestyle choices, reigning in lifestyle choices that are costly to the community, such as drugs or unbridled sexual mores or whatever. And so I think that coming off of your desire for progressives and conservatives to speak to one another, it's important if we're asking the Koch brothers to share their resources, they're going to ask, well, what are you sharing? You know, what are you giving up for the community? And that this is the capstone of this has been Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, in which he argues that he implies that the reason that the working classes, the middle classes, are having financial woes is because they don't go to church as much as rich people, and they don't marry as much as rich people. And so I think it's laughable, but in many ways. So the question is, would you just address this issue of, you know, of what we're all giving together for the community, for the community.
Thank you very much. That's actually a very thoughtful question, and you're quite right. Indeed, John Winthrop was not called a Puritan for nothing. I mean, that somebody told me I was, when I used only that quote, I was giving the lighter side of Puritanism, which is true. And you're also quite right that there are, if you will, left and right kinds of communitarians. There are, I mean, I note in the book that one of the favorite things I've been called by anybody was in the National Review, actually 20 years ago, they referred to me as a communitarian liberal. And that's actually a pretty good description of my politics. And you're right, there are many social conservatives, many pro-lifers could be fairly called, many of them actually are communitarian. They combine their pro-life commitments with a real commitment to helping poor kids and poor moms, and these things go together. And I think many of us who are liberal, and who, for example, strongly support gay rights or gay marriage, also regard ourselves as very pro-family. I think family dissolution is a problem for the whole society. I've always found the argument for gay marriage that's most powerful in some ways is the conservative argument, which says that if you believe so much in fidelity and commitment, and I do, and I think it's a value, then why in the world would you want to deny marriage to a group of people looking for an opportunity to express their fidelity and commitment to each other? But that also means that we have to say that family dissolution of various kinds, which is usually brought about by straight people, not gay people, can be a social problem. I think the problem with Murray's view is not that all those statistics are wrong. So a lot of the statistics are right. The question is why are there more family problems toward the bottom of the economy? And I think my biggest difference, well, I have a number of differences with Murray, but one of them would be that you have a lot of people who can no longer, who have more trouble making a living, making a family wage at the bottom of the economy than used to be the case. I find all of the mommy wars arguments very frustrating because in the United States today, most families cannot make it by without both the husband and wife going out for work. This is not a matter of somebody going out to work as a matter of choice. This is they have no choice. They can't even keep a spouse home for a small part of their children being young. This is the kind of issue where I really do think the left and right ought to be able to talk to each other more than they do. But what you find is, if you sound too pro-family, liberals start worrying that you have all kinds of other views. But conservatives, I think, always let market values trump family values. And so, yes, I agree. I think we could have a slightly better conversation, and it would require us to have a little bit more trust in the people we are having a dialogue with, and we don't have a lot of that right now. But thank you very much for your question. I appreciate it. Sir?
Clearly the United States has had many periods of intense disagreement among its citizens, including a civil war. How would you compare the present situation to past periods of intense disagreement? Are we in some sort of a few minutes before midnight before we get to something as horrible as another civil war, or where would you place the present controversy and so on?
I like to think we at least have half an hour. I think it's an excellent question. As I was doing this book, I was thinking a lot about that, and I am fascinated by the 1850s. What really troubles me is how similar this period feels to the period of the 1850s, when we really were so fundamentally divided that we ended up in civil war. Now, I don't think we're heading to civil war now, but you had, first of all, some of the same regional divisions as you have now. I mean, one of the odd things about our political maps is that they are totally inverted versions of the political maps of the late 1850s or 1860s. That I believe it's the case that that Barack Obama carried all of the Lincoln states, all of the Lincoln Republican states. When he got elected, he lost most of the old Confederacy, except for the three states that are now the least southern states in the South because of population movements, Virginia, Florida, and North Carolina. So there is that. There is the same degree of mistrust left and right, making left and right being the pro and anti-slavery side. Lincoln said over and over and over that he did not want to abolish slavery in the South. He only wanted to prevent its spread in the territories, yet his opponents insisted he was an abolitionist and justified secession by saying that Lincoln actually held a much stronger, held a view that he did not, in fact, hold. I was saying to some folks tonight, I'm always struck when people call Barack Obama a socialist. I mean, I actually know a lot of socialists, and they're insulted when Barack Obama is called a socialist. If doubling the Dow since 2009 is socialism, I think a lot of people in a community like this would want more socialism. And so there's something overloaded about the language, as there was in the 1850s. I think there are other periods like this. One is probably in the Gilded Age, very fierce, often violent struggles, literally between capital and labor. And then the other thing I point out in the book is that many of the arguments you're hearing from the right now go back not just to the 50s, although some of the old John Birch Society ideas are kind of floating around at the farther right edges of the Tea Party and on some of Glenn Beck's reading list. It's true. But also some of these ideas go back to opponents of the New Deal. And that many of the sort of same rhetoric you're hearing now against government, against the state, against the regulation of the market, against trying to break up concentrated private power, all these arguments were used against Roosevelt. So those are the periods. It certainly feels, I was coming of age in the 1960s. And in certain ways, that was a very violent period, and there was, a lot of discontent and a lot of alienation. But in terms of pure party division, this seems much deeper than what we experienced back in those days. The last quick point I want to make before I turn to the next question. In arguing for a long consensus, I'm not against political argument. I love political argument. Heck, I make my living at political argument, so I can't. It would be foolish of me to be against it. And I don't want everybody to hold the same views on everything. When I talk about a consensus, I'm talking about how we could have sort of very broad differences of opinion, but at least have some sense of where we want to go. some sense that, yes, government will play a substantial role in our life. Some sense that not every the solution to every problem is not a tax cut. And that when you look at where when we sit down to balance the budget, we can at least agree that some balance between revenue, tax increases and cuts is possible. We're not even there yet. So I am it's not 10 minutes to midnight, but we're not in a good place. And I don't think it's good. I think we have a way of getting out of these declinist sentiments and really sort of the reason I am not a declinist is because I think the United States is an incredibly strong country intellectually and morally. And has a capacity to be a very important power in the world, partly because of the example of our democracy for a very long time. But when our democracy doesn't function well, and it's not functioning well now, then I think we begin to lose something in the eyes of the world. It's not just that that makes us feel bad. If U.S. loses ground because our democracy doesn't work, we have a lot less capacity to advance democracy in the rest of the world. And I'm not talking about just by the force of arms or even primarily by the force of arms. I'm talking about the power of our example, which has really been pretty powerful for a long time, and we should want to grab that back.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.